For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. We recall his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. And our next guest, I'm really pleased to have with us, is Francesco Boschieri. He is the owner, president, and chief bottle washer of Vox Next. He's, which, by the way, enables us to bring our programs to you. Francesco, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don, for having me.
Well, we always ask our guests to start off with a little bit about their personal background, a little bit about their company, and then finally a website where our audience can learn more.
Sure. So, again, my name is Francesco Boschieri. I'm Italian, born and raised, even though now I live in New York. I'm an entrepreneur, and I started a couple of companies in my career. The second company I started is a company which was called Spreaker and was a website and an app that allowed people to create either a podcast or a radio show and publish it on the internet. Recently, as of last year, this company that I co-founded merged with another company active in the space whose name was Block Talk Radio, and is the company that you are currently using to produce the show. And out of this merger came a new company that we christened VoxNest.com. And the idea of VoxNest is we want to help professional podcasters thrive. We want to create the tools and solutions for enabling people to use podcasting as a business rather than a passion. So we manage at VoxNest.com.
Well, could this be in radio? Can you spell it out for our audience?
Definitely. That's VoxNest.com.
Okay. Now, friends, I have a lot of questions for you. But because of our audience is made up primarily of a small business, I'd like to concentrate there. I love your company. I wish I knew Spreaker as well as other people. I would switch to it in a minute. Right now, I've used Blog Talk Radio for over 5 years and find it very good, but not quite as good as Spreaker. And one of these days, and by the way, we should spell it out for our audience because it has a very interesting spelling. Could you spell it for our audience?
Yeah, it's basically Spreaker, like speaker with an R in between. So again, Spreaker.com.
Well, I have to tell you, I learned to use Blog Talk, and if I can use Blog Talk, anybody can use Blog Talk. And Spreaker is just a step higher, but I just haven't had enough time to learn it as well as I do Blog Talk. So there's your commercial.
We're more than happy to have you on Blog Talk, running both platforms with a slight different focus. We try to use Blog Talk for live call-in radio shows like the show that we're doing right now that makes it very easy for guests and the audience to call into a live radio show. And Spreaker is more geared towards podcasts, so pre-recorded content, even though it also supports live content. So, again, we're happy with you on Blog Talk if you find it easier.
Well, Francesco, you've been an entrepreneur. How do you explain to our audience how something like Blog Talk or a podcast can help them build their sales?
Look, there's a lot of power in using your voice to communicate your products or your services that you're selling. Voice is great because it conveys emotions and passions as well. Nobody's more passionate than the entrepreneur themselves when they speak about this product, their own product. So what I think is perfect for a small business that want to use podcasting to promote their own products or services is to use podcasting as a tool for engaging their customers and potential customers and keeping them up to date and up to speed and how their solution can really benefit the end user or the end customer in their everyday life. But we all know that it's way easier to get repetitive sales from past customers, but it might be time-consuming to have a lot of one-on-one conversation about what's going on, what are the new exciting things happening in the industry, and within the company, in the space. And podcasting is basically a great tool for doing this, as long as there's a fixed appointment, like a meeting. Think of it as a meeting every week or every couple of weeks when you have a very open and easy conversation one-on-one with your best customer. You're basically talking into their ears, and this will keep them connected to your business and basically spark repeating business, which is the holy grail of all small businesses. So I think podcasting is actually great at doing this. It's harder to use podcasting to be discovered, even though it's certainly possible. But if you think of using the audio media as a way to keep engagement once the first sale has been done, you will be surprised of the results.
Couldn't agree with you more. In your experience, Francesco, we're talking with Francesco Bascheri. He is president and leader of VoxNest. In your experience, what are the best ways a company can start to dip their toes into this, what I consider fascinating new marketing tool?
Well, the ideal is to come up with a small and repeatable plan for delivering valuable information to your target customer, your ideal customer. The error that we see more often is that people try to do too much at the beginning, and you need to think of this as a marathon, not as a sprint. So you need to pace your efforts and start with something really, really simple, but create a fixed and repetitive appointment that happens week after week after week, and create a base of content, a base of conversational content. So think of what is interesting in the space that your company is operating, and try and make it very simple and convey this information to your customers, because they probably are interested as well in the marketplace, in the space, in the market. Specifically, if you're a B2B company, your customers are other businesses, and they need to understand what's going on in order to make informed decisions about their own business. So this could be a very easy and simple way to start. Put the focus in creating value for them. Of course, you need to plug your product there, but really, really think that you're giving them value rather than basically talking about you and your product. And they will keep following. And as soon as they will be ready, this will build their trust. This will keep them informed about any new offering that you might have, solving their potential issues, and they will buy. I think that's simple. They will basically buy, because it's like you had a one-on-one conversation with Danny, with all these people on a weekly basis. And this scales to hundreds of people potentially that you can keep engaged every week.
That's great advice. Well, let's turn to your company now. What made you get into this business, into this sector, and how do you go about getting your message out to potential users?
So, well, the story of this company is weird, because I do not have a background in either radio broadcasting or podcasting. I was a listener of radio talk show, not a podcast, back in the day. I started the company 10 years ago. That's when Spreaker originally started. And my hunch was that a lot of other medias, like text and video, had undergone a transformation, moving from traditional to digital. And this hadn't happened with audio. And the reason why, my rationale was that it was still very, very hard to create and consume online audio in everyday settings. So I decided to start this. In hindsight, I was probably a bit too early. The biggest aha moment or moment of change in this market happened probably 4 years and a half ago, when Apple released the podcast application included or pre-installed in the iOS version 8. That's when a lot of people started taking notice of this media. It was not an on-off moment. I mean, people were listening to online radio and were listening to podcasts well before that, but it was just very hard for the mainstream population. We everything changed 4 years ago. And then, of course, we got to the point where today everybody is talking about podcasting, because it's an effective media and it's accessible. But again, I came to this for mainly as a technical challenge, because I'm a software engineer as a background, and I wanted to create something that was not existing. So creating a way for people to create a radio show and consume a radio show in online in a very, very easy setting. I have to say that all things considered, it was not very, very hard for us to communicate our product, at least to a sustainable audience, because our customers and our users are people who like to communicate, are people who create content that spreads around. So as long as you help them, as long as you create a product that works well for them, they will in turn talk about your company and your product, because that's what they do for a living. They talk, they communicate to other people. So immediately when we found something that was working and connecting with our user base, the product basically started advertising itself. So again, I'm spoiled. It was rather easy for us. I understand it's not easy like this in every market out there, but I think that my takeaway is that your happy customers in every single market are going to be your best marketing tool.
You're absolutely right. By the way, I read that by 2020, more people will be listening on radio via the digital than over the air. I find that fascinating. Have you heard that statistic as well?
Well, maybe that's a bit stretched. What I can say for certain is that audio is not different in its consumption pattern. Let's say the desire of people for consuming audio as a media are not different from what they desire with video or with text. They want to consume the content they want, when they want, wherever they are. And the point, look at what's happening with video. I mean, there is a big shift towards on-demand content. And by the way, online, so using the internet and digital media, is a much more convenient way of transmitting information compared to broadcasting. You can have one-on-one offerings, and it's at the end of the day, it's cheaper. And that's why I think it's inevitable that people will prefer online to terrestrial in the long run. 2020 is very close, though. So I don't think that we will see the total shift within the next 24 months or so. But definitely the landscape is changing fast.
Well, we've had several people on this program who became so enamored of podcasting, they were consultants or authors, that they've gone on to create their own shows on your show. I have to say, on Spreaker. But can we talk a minute about how consultants, which also make up part of our audience, they're doing construction outside of our studio, and I couldn't get them to stop for the halftime for this, but we'll hopefully get it. I haven't built the studio yet in my home. Maybe I should. But the question I have for you, can you talk a little bit of how consultants, people who do a lot of personal consulting, can also expand their reach by using podcasting and other tools?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, consultants are in the business of creating authority and trust for for what they think, for their knowledge, right? And podcast is a great way to do both. It's content marketing by essence. You just release pieces of free information in the form of a podcast that can solve the problem for you as a consultant to show your potential customers that you're an authority in your market and that you can deliver, basically building your trust. And this is 99% of what's needed to get customers as a consultant. So you need to approach podcasting as a very small free consultation on the topics that you are selling to your audience, and it would just work. And it's basically both a lead generation system and a system to overcome fear that most buyers will have when they think of hiring a consultant.
Wow, that is really good. I hadn't ever thought of it that way, but what a great idea. In the few minutes we have left, what are some of your thoughts about the future of podcasting and things in general, the digital area?
Well, what we see happening as of today in podcasting, it's the fact that, shockingly, more and more people in the audience are starting to use it. So it's over the past 3 to 4 years, it's really becoming mainstream media as a way to consume content. Like literally everybody nowadays is aware of new shows and new podcasts coming out. This has also raised the bar in terms of the content that people expect to find into a podcast and the production quality and things like that. But the truth is that at the end of the day, this is a beautiful media that can very easily accommodate niches. There's a lot of content that goes very, very deep in very, very narrow niches, and that's what I find fascinating about podcasts. What I think we will see is the proliferation of this as creating shows and distributing shows become easier for everybody. Of course, big media companies are coming to the medium here, and their number one priority right now is monetization. And it's what's weird about this media today is that there's a lot of engagement, but not enough dollars compared to the amount of engagement that the media shows. And this is going to change pretty soon. Also, the demographics of listeners and thus the genre of content that's being created is changing quickly. Back in the day, or at least more than 4 or 5 years ago, the podcast audience used to be very tech-savvy, skewing the male demographics, just because creating shows and accessing the medium was hard and required a little bit of technical expertise. As these barriers collapse and more people flow into the medium, we see more diverse content emerging into the shows. So I really believe that 2019 would be a turning point for this medium. We'll see probably large publishers go all in. Some will be successful, some won't. But also at the same time, it's important that the independent and small shows stay alive because they provide a value that's hard to find in every other media. Because all the other media that you can consume digitally require your attention and your eyes fixed on a screen, whether it's text, images, or videos. Podcasting is the only thing that you can do while you're driving or while you're exercising or doing something else. And the fact that so much content in so many varieties is available on this platform makes it unique, and people will appreciate it more and more.
Yeah, that is really terrific. But let me ask you a question. Where where do you think the advertising will come from, and do you intend to get into the advertising sales business?
We are already in the advertising sales business on the Spreaker platform and on the Block Talk Radio platform. Actually, we are doubling down on the Spreaker platform. We make it very easy for content producers to define where they want a piece of advertising in their own show, and we connect them with advertisers digitally. I mean, it's a whole automatic process like Google AdSense for blogs. We've built the same process for podcasts, so you don't need to go out and sell anything. You just tell us that you want, I don't know, a number of ad breaks, let's say two ad breaks each, of whom with two 30-second ads within your show, and it's done. We'll just provide you with the ads and send you the check at the end of the month. And it's growing more and more. Historically, in this medium was the domain of direct response advertisers, which are those advertisers that can measure the effectiveness of their ads by giving away a coupon code and counting the number of buys that happen through that coupon code or vanity URL. Nowadays, what we see is that more and more brand advertisers are coming to the space, and this is great because brand advertisers do larger buys, do larger flights in terms of campaign duration, and tend to pay slightly more. And as more dollars are flowing into the industry, now believe it or not, the challenge that lies ahead with podcasting is how do we make advertiser able to spend those dollars? Because right now, most of the tools for buying and selling advertising are manual, and they only provide a viable business model for large shows. For medium to smaller shows, it's very hard to justify the salaries of media buyers and media sellers exchanging information back and forth just to sell an ad. So automation needs to kick in, and that's also what I think will happen in 2019. Definitely, we are working on this to solve this problem.
Francesco Baschieri, he's president of VoxNest.com. I could go on for hours with you, but unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time together. Thank you so much. One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes, by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. Our guest right now is Greg Witt. He's young youth brand strategist and chief strategy officer of Engage Youth. Greg, welcome
to
the program.
Yeah, thank you.
I see you're going to be one of our enthusiastic ones. Greg, first, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, then a little bit about your company, and finally your website.
All right. Well, cool, man. That's a huge nut to break off there. I am a youth marketing strategist and an entrepreneur by trade. I'm a former professional skateboarder, and I've been in pursuit of the fountain of youth my entire life. Now, I've just been sort of involved in youth culture and brands and businesses associated, close proximity to that in my whole career. And I've, got my start early on when I founded Good Times Skateboards and Apparel when I was 16, living in Minnesota. Long story short, have founded several leading youth demographic targeted agencies over the years, and now am a founder, partner, and chief strategy officer at the helm of Engage Youth Co. And stay tuned and see where we go. We're doing some pretty radical things as a agency service provider, from insights, strategy, and media, different forms of media activation. So try to give you a short version there.
Okay, so in short, you know a lot about youth and how to market to
them.
Yeah.
That's the practice that myself and my team is solely focused on. Of course, that also has to do with the family and certain aspects, but that's correct.
Okay, and your website, before we go any further,
is engageyouth.com. Very easy. EngageYouth.com.
Yes, but this is a radio, so spell it out for.
Okay. youth, youth, .com.
Okay. So now, the subject we're going to talk about today is youth, which I'm long past, and I'm always fascinated by it. So I guess my first question is, how do you define youth?
Well, I tend to break youth into four key segments. So we've got kids that are under eight, 8 and under, and you can break that down to preschool, of course, but kids under eight, 9 and under, or under 9. And then we have the 9 to 12, which is the tweens, which is a very interesting developing and growing group as far as life stage and, you know, and so forth. And then we have teens, you know, 13 to 18, 13 to 19, depending on how you look at it. And then we have our young adults in that 18, 19-ish to early 20s. Those are the main four areas that we help brands connect and develop, you know, marketing solutions, relationships, you know, make the connection for. Those are the main groups. But also there's the cultural side, which is sort of age, you know, I don't want to say age, maybe not age agnostic, not the right word, but like the age doesn't matter, or depending on the different types of youth cultural groups that we also target. So that's another, you know, area where I'm focused. So.
Well, okay. So we've got basically four different groups. Do you specialize in one group, or do you provide marketing help for each of those groups?
We do provide consumer insights and marketing work for each of those groups, but I'll say that the tween and teen is the primary focus for sure. And then we do a certain amount of work in the kids area, a lot of insights work in the kids area. And then we do some marketing programs that cross into young adults and older. But the mm-hmm. actual sweet spot, I guess, is really teens at the end of the day.
Well, okay. So our audience is primarily small businesses, some consumer, et cetera. Let's start with the teen group first. Then we'll go into the sub-team. But what are some of the insights you can provide for our audience?
Well, I think it's really important to know that some of the generational markers of teens, of the teens of Gen Z, it certainly applies to the tweens as well, are incredible knowledge managers. I guess often, you know, represented as having short attention spans, but they've, as people, as culture and as people, especially at earlier ages, have developed the ability to quickly filter, you know, massive quantities of information that appears on their screens and really decide what's worth and, you know, what should be filtered. So they definitely have an always on BS filter, but I tend to more articulate that as knowledge managers, just because they've don't know anything other than all the information coming at them, whereas we've adapted to it. Another really important, I guess, aspect of teens today is that they're incredibly diverse. So as a global demographic group, you know, Gen Z is definitely not just do they, you know, respect all ethnicities, races, genders, and orientations. They really expect those values be reflected in the brands and classrooms or media or whatever you have that's trying to reach them. So that's like super important. I've got a lot longer list, but maybe those are two to really rev up the conversation. I don't know. I can keep going forever, right? So,
I'm sure you can, but let's back up a little bit and let's concentrate primarily on the U.S. and Canada, because that's where almost the bulk of our audience is. And you say that they have an incredible ability to process information and to filter information. What do you mean
definitely
by that?
On the filtering side? Yeah. Well, for instance, they see so many different images and I guess interfaces and messages and you know, every type of multimedia coming at them, that their minds are faster and quicker at swiping away from something and immediately just looking at the whole big picture of anything, any ad, use an ad as an example, very fast to give one glance at it and say, oh, that's not for me, that's something for me. They're less open to be sold to just because there's more coming at them at once. There's more to filter. So they're just getting quicker at filtering. It doesn't mean they're necessarily always right or that the processor is improved per se, but they just from just the sake of survival, they have to be able to filter through what they want, what they need, and what is absolutely not for them really quick. Or they'll have no more time in their day, right?
So in other words, if I'm hearing you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that whatever the message is, it has to be very quick, very direct, and appeal to them almost immediately. Am I hearing that right?
You heard loud and completely clear. And I think that the main important aspect of all the items you've mentioned is that targeting, that it's very, whatever you are messages, that it's highly targeted to the groups, subgroups, and on down to the individual as close as possible.
Well, you know,
shotgun's over. The shotgun don't work anymore.
I'm sorry, say that again.
The old school blanketing media through broadcast media, the shotgun media approach just doesn't work anymore. Unless it's a part of an overall integrated equation.
So are you saying, for instance, social media, the idea that you're reaching them when they're looking at their iPhone, et cetera, is critical to this whole process?
I think mobile first is critical. I think that having the right message and the right content and the right offers at the right times and the right situations for the group is more important than the device. Look, channels, mediums, billboards, TV, social media, whatever it might be, live streaming, they're all just channels and they change all the time. But the difference is because you can now to reach young people specifically, we're talking teens, with messages and content that most applies to the situation they're in at the moment that they're consuming that content.
Okay.
Timing, place.
See, what I don't understand, I look at, for instance, a Pepsi commercial, and it is very quick, it's flash, et cetera. And to me, it's too fast, and I never get the message. But I'm told from other people that because it's fast and flashy, it is, in fact, sending a message to the youth which it's aimed at. Am I missing that, or it seems to be part of what you're saying?
Yeah, it really depends too. So if it's what channel that it's on. Like if it's on TV, it depends. Like there's different, typically. I shouldn't say typical, but the idea of a shorter, 15, 30 second, up to 1 minute, 2 minute content is very, very effective with teens and young people. But as you know, they'll also watch gaming and beauty vlogger tutorials that go for an hour. So it's really, if the content's relevant to them, the channel's very much secondary, so to speak, like television, social media, radio, podcasting. It's really like the relevance of the message and the situation that they're in at the time that is more important than the channel. Now it's probably a separate discussion, but it's very, very difficult to reach young people through TV. They're just not consuming television. I don't want to state the obvious, but that does, I guess, somewhat play into this here, to this conversation.
But you're absolutely right there. I know that just watching what's being bought for television. Since I'm an older person, I'm looking at television more than my iPhone. But let me ask you this. What do you mean, what kind of effective content can you throw at youth that will make encourage them to listen to your message?
Actually, it goes a little bit deeper than that, really. First, you have to really make sure that the identity of the brand or the product line, depending on what it is relevant or relatable to that audience. And then through your content and through your message, you need to be able to be building trust, being found and discovered as relevant, and creating sort of a sense of belonging in the experiences that you're creating. So I know, unfortunately, it's kind of a complex answer, but you really have to be targeted in what the message and the content is in order to be effective. And that's the overarching kind of law.
Yeah, I understand that.
I mean, you can say, like, I mean, it is definitely, showing empathy to others is a really effective type of content or message, depending on the type of brand or the social channel. Obviously, humor, I want to say it's obvious, but humor is kind of, tops. So there's different types of content based that are sort of popular native types of content, that popular content native to different social platforms is also key. So it gets pretty complex, right, when you break it down. Because it's like, you might not be a funny brand, but then there might be some platforms you might not want to be on then, because they're more along the lines of, funnier, content. So it's having a very thoughtful social and digital channel strategy is critical.
We're talking
about George. I skirted around the question, but I didn't mean to skirt all around the question about trying to dive in deeper to it.
Well, I know it's a highly complex question. But first, let me get a commercial in for you, Greg. We're talking with Greg Witt. He's the Chief Strategy Officer of EngageYouth.com. We're here talking about how to reach youth, which is I teach a course every year at Columbia University for high school editors and reporters. And over the last 10 years, I've noticed such a marked difference in the audience, in my audience. I have had to change my course to kind of meet them halfway. And I still get, when I say things, blank expressions on their face because they're simply not attuned to some of those things. But now I'm going to ask you, Greg, to me, a small business, let us say it's a T-shirt store, which I think has great appeal to youth. Am I correct?
With their good T-shirts, it sure does. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I can.
Oh, a T-shirt, where they print T-shirts to fit the to the need of the students, et cetera. For instance, 10 years ago, printing the a high school graduating class names on the back of a T-shirt was, but now having talked to the a couple of stores recently for something else, I find that that's gone out of favor, in favor of what you said, which is some cause-related something that they want to add to it, something cause-related, et cetera. How does a T-shirt company, to use an example, reach out and get their message across to youth, in your view?
Well, typically what they'll do is they'll find cultural or interest groups that most align or associate with their brand, identity, and then line that up with different, targeted audiences, say people into, cosmetics unboxing, action sports, obviously esports and gaming. And then they'll find, different brands and different individuals. We call them influencers or content creators, but talented people or smart people with followings. And they find a way to incorporate these individuals and sometimes other brands that are doing collaborations together and create something together that adds value to the people that they're targeting. So whether it's some special shirt, I'm trying to riff here with you, or it's promoting something exclusive type of promotion or access to X, Y, or Z. But really going sort of deeper to spending the time to really understand the consumer better and create special content for them. You also mentioned being purpose-driven. That's a huge trend, that one that I don't think is going to stop, you know, anytime soon, since it's been around since forever. But it's growing to, you know, have social impact, have your product mean something, have it stand for something, have proceeds go to support a cause important to you, right? There's a lot of room for even more t-shirt brands, even more other types of products to have a purpose. So the quick Cliff Notes version is really focusing your efforts on consumer engagement, creating something of value, positioning your brand to be relatable to the audiences. And then it's going to be all about having real effective, interesting storytelling that, again, the people that can help carry that message and influence, and then different types of digital and real world experiences to kind of get in and really, you know, be part of that particular brand. And it's like the $1 million question, you know, that you asked. So it's a good question.
Well, Greg, let me ask you a different question. You talk about influencers, and, you know, I read about people have a million followers, et cetera, and some of these people I've never heard of, but apparently have a million. how do they accumulate these people, and how do you then co-opt them to convince other people of the products? To buy the products, because obviously they do it to.
There's a right way and a wrong way of doing it, isn't there? The wrong way of doing it is to just pay the influencer or the talented individual or group with just like a one-off ad or a one-off campaign where the influencer just basically, hey, check this out, or hey, I wear this. You know, I think the key. I guess brands that are really successful at influencer marketing or creator partnerships, however we want to call it, that type of collaboration, are those that involve the influencer, the creator, as almost a part of the family or as a part of a more longer-term relationship-building ambassador program. And that, you know, these one-off sort of, you know, blatant ads are proving really to be ineffective, and there's no brand loyalty being built. So, you know, really brands are going to be more productive top, bottom line, I guess, if they work with a handful of creators that really hit their demographic hard and turn these individuals into ambassadors that are really wholeheartedly backing the product or service, you know, because as they say, you know, if they're really truly ambassadors, their fans will be too.
That's really interesting. We're talking with Greg Witt. He's Chief Strategy Officer of Engage Youth. But you said there was we've talked about one, but you also said there was another area you want to talk about.
We could talk about my new book, The Gen Z Frequency, How Brands Tune In and Build Credibility. Now, that didn't sound like an ad, did it?
but you said it too fast. Say it slower, okay. So I can hear it.
Yeah.
Remember, this is radio, and your audience is a little bit older than your teens.
Yeah. No, my new book is titled The Gen Z Frequency, How Brands Tune In and Build Credibility with Youth Culture. It's really a book that goes beyond talking about a generational demographic and more of an understanding of how to actually listen to, involve, and then engage youth audiences. So it's a very actionable to engage young people. And if you do get a chance to read it, give it a read and let me know what you think.
Well, I will, but let's talk about a little bit. What are some of the things you say in the book? Give us a little taste of it.
So, you know, in the book, we we talk about some backstories of brands that have are very, very successful today with teens and youth and pop culture, but weren't always like that. So it talks about a few true stories of brands that are that found youth culture relevance. We go through, and in the book, I should say, shares a sociological perspective on Gen Z, more the fact, more, you know, where they come from, who the people are, less sort of subjective stuff. But it provides a good baseline to kind of really understand who this demographic is on a national, but also on a global level. It is interesting. And then some of the big factors of Gen Z. And then fundamental to the book is the kind of the backbone of the book are the five foundational truths of youth marketing. They are identity, trust, relevance, possibility, and experience. And these foundational youth market truths or principles, if you will, are really the starting point for understanding and defining brand consumer relationships with any audience, but it's very particular in the way that it was approached in the book to helping guiding youth focused initiatives. Then there's a
Greg, before you go further, because it's the radio, would you repeat those five? Because I found them fascinating, but please repeat those.
In the book, I've identified through our experience working with youth marketing five foundational truths or principles being identity, trust, relevance, possibility, like the aspirational, and then experience. And certainly can dive deep into each of those, but that's kind of the backbone that drives the book. And then we go into how to align with culture, it's kind of a youth and cultural approach to segmentation. So identifying the various different targeted demographic segments and cultural psychographic segments for each part, each aspect of youth. And then we really go from how to conduct research and how to do co-creation. Lots of interviews with people from Lego, people from Nike, people from Complex Media, action-packed full of case studies from global cosmetic brands, Carhartt, you name it. And then I think it kind of, as it goes to the end, it gets to very, very actionable worksheets in the youth culture engagement playbook, as well as lots of strategic and tactical considerations from social media to experiential. And then it ends and closes with a pretty robust section on how to measure or evaluate performance on social and influence programs. So it's a pretty comprehensive field guide, if you will, where you can use this book to get inspiration and ideas, but you can also use this book as a field guide to implement marketing programs.
Greg, very slowly, the name of the book again and where people could get it?
Yeah, absolutely. Didn't know. So the Gen Z Frequency is a comprehensive guide for any brand or organization wanting to build relationships with this group. And it covers everything from social media, content creation and campaigns, experiential and emerging technologies, including case studies and examples from leading youth brands, like mentioned, Nike, Glossier, Carhartt, Instagram, and not only the stories from marketing experts, but from Gen Z themselves. And it is a ultimate resource for engaging Gen Z, the Gen Z Frequency.
And Greg, we have to have you back to talk more about it, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. Your website again for people?
Oh, it's engageyouth.com, engageyouth.com.
You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.